Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm joined with my co-host, Chris Merman.
Howdy.
Hey, Chris. And today we're joined with Matt Barcombe and Melissa Perry.
Hey.
Yep.
Hello, hello. Melissa Perry is the CEO of Products Labs out of Brooklyn, New York. And Matt is the Director of Consulting for Products Labs. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really excited to talk with you both today. We're going to be talking about the concept here of living roadmaps. So you guys are both experts in the product space and the product management world. So let's start with a very general question for both of you. What's wrong with the way that we're currently roadmapping?
Just the lies.
Are there specific lies?
If we just fix the lies, everything would be better.
Okay. What's your favorite lie?
About when we're going to actually deliver something in 3 years because we put it on a piece of paper.
Okay.
The big lie. Yeah. I think a lot of people treat roadmaps not as more of a communication device as what they are intended for. They treat it more as a place where they can put commitments into a Gantt chart like form where we write down, oh, we're going to release, you know, this feature by January 2018. And we've done very little work to actually understand that feature, understand if it's the right feature, understand if we can actually build it, how long that's going to take, all those wonderful things. And yet we're committing to a date. And some companies even have these things, right? Some of them are 5 years long, right? Down to the nitty-gritty details of everything they're going to do for the next 5 years, which just seems crazy to me.
It's crazy. And they tend to convey a stronger sense of accuracy or confidence than, you know, reality shows us. And what's really weird is it doesn't matter how many times reality comes back and smacks us in the face. You know, they're just like, well, let's just keep going back to the same roadmap tool of promises in the future that never seem to happen.
Just because we don't know how else to communicate it, right?
Yep.
Well, somebody doesn't. We do.
As a follow-up question, I want to empathize, Melissa, with what you said about not understanding the work. I was working with the product manager today who said, my boss's boss gave me a business case that he wants me to start getting estimates on from IT. And I said, okay, well, what did he give you? And she's like, he literally gave me a sentence and I'm supposed to be getting estimates based upon this.
Well, and she literally gave you a sentence.
Yeah.
Like you'll probably be in jail if you don't deliver.
Yeah. And there's probably, and I, as you press in, it's like, yeah, there's expectations around deliverables and it, you know, one of those, like, I don't know what it is, but I'll know it when I see it kind of things.
Mm-hmm. The craziest one I've actually ever heard of too was there was a company that hired one of the very big consulting firms in there to go and scope out, you know, what they were doing, what they should be doing. And they basically handed them a roadmap that was 5 years long with every little thing that every team should be working on, you know, all the way out for 5 years in a Gantt chart like form. And when I talked to the product managers about it, I said, should you even be building this? And they're like, no, we've talked to the customers. They don't actually want it. but we have to build it because it's on the roadmap and it's been promised. So.
Oh my gosh. Do you think that pressure, like the pressure for publishing that and making it, you know, such a long running plan, is that internal pressure in most organizations or external pressure?
I think it's both. Yep. I mean, you see, you certainly see like sales organizations that are selling ahead of the roadmap or further ahead of the roadmap than they should be. And those are external because, I mean, in the worst case scenario, you're now contractually obligated for, you know, features or capabilities that don't exist in your product. But, you know, a good half of it is also internal. It's I don't know if self-imposed is quite hard enough, but, you know, promises have been made up and sometimes up as to executive, sometimes up as to a board of directors by the executive team. And, you know, people don't have the political capital. You don't want to lose face. There's too much on the table to say that you can't make it when, you know, the reality is we shouldn't be talking about all of those things in that way anyways. We should be talking about, you know, probabilities, likelihoods, percent delivered, things like that, that are, you know, better ways of talking about how the reality of our space actually works.
Mm-hmm. Ah, percent delivered. That's an interesting one. I don't know that I've ever seen that really part of a roadmap before. And it seems like it should be.
Isn't it always like 70% until it's delivered?
Yeah. I mean, it's like when a baby is only in the third trimester, second trimester, it's 66% delivered.
No, it's more about like the probability. If you think of it, like I like the way that Matt thinks of this, it's kind of like a sales funnel, right? If you get a lead into a sales funnel, right? There is a certain percentage that will actually convert at the end of the day. It's the same thing in the early stages of product development, right? We shouldn't be actually building everything we think up of, everything that we're exploring, everything that we're looking at. We should be really discerning about what actually makes it through in order for us to start coding and developing it, because building software is expensive. And if we build absolutely every idea that comes our way, right, what are we doing? How are we actually judging what should be delivered, right? And that's how you get these crazy products that like nobody knows how to use anymore because they're just overloaded with features. So if you back up and start thinking about it as in the early stages of really figuring out what we should be doing or figuring out what is the right thing to build, there should be a lower probability, right, that it's going to actually make it to a customer-facing thing one day. Hopefully we're testing it and we're killing those bad ideas early.
It's like the 20 fingers rule of product development. You gotta take that extra step before you ship it.
The 20 fingers rule.
You gotta get it nice and validated before we ship it. Isn't
that? What is this?
We gotta. Never mind.
Okay, I don't know this song.
I was gonna say too. I hear a lot of deferred commitment in there too. You know, deferring commitment until that concept of deferring commitment until the last responsible moment, or until you actually need or have bandwidth. Even
it's also about like what are we committing to, right? In the early stages, I might commit to solving a validated problem, but I'm not going to commit to a specific solution, right? First, I got to figure out what's the right solution in those stages, but I might actually commit to solving this problem that we know is a very big problem for our users and will get us some value. But I'm not going to tell you exactly what feature it is yet until I go out and figure out what's the best feature. And that was something that got back to about like, I think it was like 6 years ago, I wrote a blog post called The Problem Roadmap, which was about that, right? Like, which was really aligning our roadmaps into how do they be more problem facing rather than committing to solutions, right? And we use that a lot branching into Matt's flow-based road mapping, and we're kind of combining those types of ideas about how do we communicate the work and the stages that we're at with the work, and how do we get it to be different levels of commitment and different levels of predictability so that you understand what we're doing when we talk to you about the roadmap, but we're not promising things that we haven't quite validated yet.
How much of that do you think comes from financing and funding? Because a lot of times I've experienced that these features that they need done, a lot of it came from, well, we got money and it's burning a hole in our pocket and we don't want to lose it the next time, right? So what role does that play in this?
I don't know. Like, I think for mature organizations, and you'd know more about how it works with the mentality of the founders or the executives in the startup space, but like, I would hope it shouldn't matter, because at the end of the day, it should be about ROI. Mm-hmm. So if whomever is giving you the money is seeing you ship features that no one gives a shit about, like, why? Mm-hmm. You know, if we were starting to track feature usage, you know, percent feature used per feature deployed, and we started seeing that ratio go horribly wrong, hopefully somebody would be like, why am I giving you Benjamins to keep shipping features that no one's using? Like, that's a giant waste of time and money.
And it's interesting because in the startup world, it's completely opposite, right? Like, nobody would ever be like, I need you to ship all these features because I have money that's burning a hole in my pocket, right?
Like, that's money.
That doesn't, the lot less money. They usually have no money. So they're not that kind of pressure, right? Like, it's not a fact of, oh, spend all this money because I need you to ship. It's more like, we need to hit our goals or we need to make money, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean that leads to all the right decisions, but it's the pressure is not from, oh, I have to spend my money. It's more like, I have to make money. I have to put ourselves in a good position to be stable. Yeah, and I think those enterprises, like, they lose that, right?
The ones that have too much money.
Too much money. Yeah. And they're like, I don't know what to do with it. So they do these, you know, crazy yearly budgeting processes where they're like, okay, you get $3 million. You get $3 million. Everybody gets $3 million. We'll just be Oprah here, right? Like, and then you got to spend it, and then you won't get it back if you don't spend it. So I was talking to a lot of product teams and a CTO of a very large financial institution that did like a budgeting like that, right? And they were saying, you know, we get down to November and we haven't spent the rest of our money and we just build whatever the hell we want to build. So we spend it. And he's like, it's the most useless thing. All of us know we're not building the right thing, but if we don't spend it, we'll never get that kind of money again. And you're like, how do people think this is a good idea? Like, yes, it's predictable. And I think it's easier to manage. It's probably easier. That's the trick, right? Like, it's probably easier to keep track of, every team has a budget and they have to spend that budget, right?
That's true.
From an enterprise level, because you have so many teams. But is it the right thing to do? No.
Yeah.
That happens all the time, though. Like, what you're describing, Melissa, is that they don't want to blow their budget in the first quarter. So my current client, very 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 giant company, right? And what's interesting is as coaching becomes more of a thing, the rates keep going up, and the companies that are affording our services, mm-hmm. they're bigger and bigger. Like, my clients just keep getting bigger and bigger. So because of that, they get these giant projections of how much they're going to spend for the year, and by the time you get to where we're at right now, they've burned through maybe 10% of their capital for the year, and because they're trying to be frugal and show that they can do more with less. But then they hit August, and the internal employees were telling me, "You watch, by the time we hit August, our roadmaps will double or triple in size."
Yeah. It's interesting too, because I learned about this just at this conference in Australia that I was at by Bjarte Bognes from Beyond Budgeting. Like, this whole system that you're describing is called budget-based management.
Oh,
was actually invented by McKinsey and introduced to companies that way. So that's the way that they've been taught to run it through that. I don't know all the details on that, but I heard this story. I wouldn't be the right person to repeat the story, but I mean, fully, but it is something to like look into, right? And that's where that came about, right? Nobody really ran organizations like that until McKinsey came out and said, hey, this is budget-based management. It's a much easier way to drive your business through accounting type methods where it's very predictable and you can see where all the financial targets are and they cascade down and they're easy to keep track of. And that's what stuck.
And it's a great example of optimizing for the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Like standard teams.
Yeah. He invented it 100 years ago. I just had to Google that, but yes. And he was, they solved the problem. It was for General Motors, right? That's who they were implementing.
Wait, like literally 100 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, I totally thought you made that number up.
So tell us, you mentioned the concept of living product roadmaps. Tell us what you mean by that and what that concept is.
Yeah, so we've been kind of combining our ideas on what makes good roadmaps and how do we get there. And one of the concepts and the reason why we kind of went back and forth about what do you name this, right? And we settled on this living roadmaps idea, because the roadmap shouldn't be like a static snapshot of these are all the things we're going to release by these dates. It's actually more about, what do we know at this time? And what do we know? It emerges over time, right? It emerges as work happens to become more certain about what we're going to release and when. But it starts off as, you know, outlining what we have to do and who has to do that. And it goes through different phases to get there.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the some of the stuff that I think is tricky still, and I think it's important in some of the key things that how you label and what you measure as part of that, and rising those things to the top, because at some point you're still going to have like, my favorite example is still the board of directors who the executive team has a quarterly meeting with. You know, even though the roadmap itself is and should be a living thing that's changing as we get new information, hopefully with faster and faster feedback cycles, they're probably still only looking at it every 3 months. So how do you take a living document and communicate it in such a way that's, you know, that people are going to look at once every 3 months and still not get them to treat it as a set of promises with high levels of certainty? And again, that's where things like, you know, for different kinds of things in the roadmap, understanding the percentiles of things like lead times or cycle times associated with those things, understanding the percent delivered. So if we've got, you know, newer tech, newer market projects that are in a farther away stage of development, we might expect to only see 20% delivered on those. So one out of every five makes it to production. And that might be different if we've got a cash cow product, an established customer base. We're not really trying to grow it in terms of spreading it anywhere. We're just fixing the bugs, adding some key features to keep up with market demand. You know, we would expect to see a higher percent delivered at earlier stages in that. So it's not just, you know, there's no one size fits all. And of course, everything needs to fit to a company's context as well. So I don't know. I mean, the idea that I think that the roadmap is living is good, but figuring out how to communicate what's on the roadmap in terms of data and statistics you have around likelihoods and key things like entry and exit criteria as work moves through various major stages of discovery and delivery are also key for key stakeholders to understand.
And I think I've heard all of us mention some kind of quarterly concept in some capacity with roadmaps we've experienced in the past. How do you leverage that data to help, I guess, break free from what could potentially be like a time-boxed cadence?
What do you mean?
Well, so I think for most organizations, they do quarterly roadmap planning, or even in SAFe, we have kind of concepts of a quarterly or every 3 month planning cycle around what we're going to deliver. What in the living roadmap concept helps move away from that, or do you move away from that?
I think you can move away from it. I mean, I think the delivery cadence of what goes to production should be completely like the release cadence mm-hmm. should be completely agnostic of your planning cadences.
Yep.
If you meet with your board of directors quarterly because you're owned by whatever, an equity firm or something, and they want to hear things quarterly because Wall Street, that's fine. If you ship to prod 12 times a day, those two things should not, like, they touch, but one shouldn't be the other. So I think actually what winds up being beneficial when you start having a living roadmap that funnels things through in a flow-based way, it allows you to be more fluid in your planning. If for whatever reason your product can't ship but once a year, great. Flow-based roadmaps, living roadmaps can achieve that for you, because at the end of the day, how you plan and think and experiment and discover and deliver, that doesn't change. If you're shipping to prod 12 times a day, you know, if you're doing continuous delivery, continuous deployment, then certainly a living roadmap is going to be much more advantageous for continuous planning. So the cool thing is at the end of the day, work moving through these phases is just a natural state of work in our environment. You know, the kinds of software, the kinds of systems that we're building is less knowable up front, is less, we have to do discovery, we have to sense and respond. So, you know, it's the methods that used to work, you know, 20 to 40 years ago just simply aren't the models that fit our context anymore.
Or 100 years ago.
Or 100 years ago.
So what I guess would you, what I feel like you're describing both of you is a, would you say this is a lean type document exercise? And if so, like what are the pieces from existing roadmaps that you feel like needed to be stripped away?
Yeah. So like I think a big part of it is to remember that this is this is a little bit of a lean exercise, but it's also about driving context and awareness throughout an organization, right? It's about communicating and making sure that people are aware of where things are at what stage, and communicating the right level of it. So there's this whole element of being able to relate everything we're doing back to our strategy, right? The roadmap is kind of one of the later parts of strategy deployment, right? We've deployed all our goals throughout our organization. We understand what our strategic intents are from the top. We now know what our product initiatives are. How do we start communicating the work that is happening to fulfill them in a meaningful way throughout the organization? And how do we do that so that it's allowed to go through these different phases, like Matt's saying, where we have these the certainty at the different phases, right? So there needs to be some context awareness about what the outcomes are for the work that we're actually driving, right? Why are we solving these problems, right? What type of goals do we hope to hit from it? Like, what are we going to drive for both our business and our customers by doing that? So having some kind of that element into the roadmap.
So that's actually interesting, because as you're talking through that, I'm thinking that's adding something in. It's adding context about goals on which you're in. And so, Chris, to your question, I'd actually say, we're not stripping things out. Yeah. We're actually adding things in. We're adding things like goal and alignment and measurability and understanding the probabilistic nature of what's in that roadmap. We're adding things like maybe work in process limits and explicit criteria for entering or exiting a state of work, whatever that is. So I actually think in some ways it's the lean aspects to it or whatever is adding something to the roadmap, because most roadmaps that I've seen are either communicated as like tabular lists with dates or Gantt charts.
Yep.
And they're actually, I think, overly simple. You see Q1 to Q4 from left to right, and it looks like a set of promises that either never gets delivered on or are padded, like so padded you can't be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like what you're describing is you're taking going back to your initial answer of lies, right? You're taking the numbers that are lies and actually putting more valuable and realistic types of data that actually tell a better story.
Yeah.
And so in a way it could seem like there's a ton more than what we're used to seeing. It's just more honest, right?
I hope so. I mean, when I think of like, you know, feature X is going to be delivered by March. Okay, that's probably what's usually communicated in most traditional roadmaps. In something more like a living roadmap, obviously the living aspect is that it's updated as we're learning, but pieces of that key information that could still be, you know, conveyed in a snapshot format is delivered by March with a 65% likelihood.
Yep.
And by the way, that feature is aligned to this goal, which is going to help us increase revenue by X percent. And this feature specifically, we believe, will move the needle by this portion. So like making sure that we've got alignment of work on the roadmap to the goals and objectives of the company in a measurable way that we can prove or disprove happened. And then understanding then what's the likelihood of that happening. We're not adding a ton of information, but I think it's the key pieces that are missing to help communicate the message that we really need to send. We're just not operating in the context of such certainty up front that there's so much known that we can speak with that kind of certainty before we've started the work.
And in this model that you guys are talking through, does the size of the item or the feature factor in to this process, or can they vary in size?
Does size matter? Is that what you're asking?
Does size matter? I am asking.
Well, I know for me it does. I don't want to speak for everybody on the podcast.
Okay, I'm good. All right, I'm better.
So what's the angle of the roadmap?
I'm better now. Thank you, Matt. I'm sorry.
I'm here to serve.
A really loud laugh. I'm sorry.
So certainly size, especially for the kinds of things that hit the roadmap sort of level, you know, we're not talking little teensy user stories here and there. We're talking about chunkier things,
yep.
And things that are fuzzier. So depending on where they're at in the discovery or delivery process. So when you're talking about something like that, a whole feature set,
yeah,
more features is going to take more time. But I don't think you have to get down to like my favorite thing is when I see roadmap items that have been like hours estimated by devs to like, this is going to be 837 hours.
Yeah,
I'm like, are you sure it's not 833?
Right.
And I think too, like the level of the right communication, right, is probably at a, and I see this sometimes with junior product managers, it's hard for them to describe it. I think Matt and I just witnessed this a bunch this year. The right level to talk about on the roadmap too is like a theme base level, right? Of like, we are going to release a solution that can enable you to do this, right? Not, we're going to put the button on this page so that you can click on it, right? There's like a right level of communication in user stories, as Matt said, it's not what should be on your roadmap. It should be more high level about that. It should be more like, what is the package that we're going to ship that delivers value, like into these, maybe it's a couple pieces that deliver value, right? But what are the different themes of the things that are all going to roll up into that?
And I think that's key for, it's key for product managers to be able to explore the problem space. It's key for dev teams to be able to explore the solution space. But even outside of product management and product development, it's key for how we have to, because as we move in this direction, we actually have to, like, in some organizations, retrain sales and retrain marketing to how to create their materials that they need and how to communicate with the very real and needed conversations that they're happening. So like how to communicate thematic roadmap ideas, when is it okay to talk about more specifically feature sets that are coming out and when, versus like how are we just keeping in touch with the industry, how are we staying ahead of things. So all those things actually kind of move as organizations become more product-led and start building kind of the heart of delivery around like a living roadmap.
So we're not really saying the word, but we're kind of talking around it in this whole conversation. When Colleen and I had Jeff Patton and Gotelf on, I asked them this thing. It's my favorite thing to ask product people is how do you understanding and visualizing value. So I guess in the living product roadmap, how would you say that you understand and visualize it? And then just in general, like how do you even think that we should understand it overall?
Value of the roadmap.
You mean the value of the items in the roadmap?
Just value in general, right? We're delivering value. These features we have to have some sort of value.
Think about it almost as like all the items on the roadmap are hypotheses, right? And what we're doing is we're aligning that roadmap to a goal. Right. So explicitly it says what the value is. We believe. So we're basically saying, like, we believe that these items on these roadmaps will hit this goal. Right. That's about as visually putting it back to value as you can. If they're not, we have a problem. Right. That should be like realigning everybody in the company to why are we doing the things we're doing. And then I think, too, there's an element that on every item in your roadmap, whether it's in, a new state of we only understand the problem, we don't know what the solution is yet, and we want to track that problem and start to understand it, it should still relate back to the goal, right? Like it's always going to drive back to that value. And we're doing the work as things progress through each bucket on this flow-based roadmap, right, to make sure that it's getting more certain that we are going to deliver the value, right? That's all the work that we do. That's the kind of requirements of pulling it from, into the next bucket. That means that it's going to get worked on and start to be looked at now, is that we're getting more certain that it is going to deliver value, which means we need to put more people on it. We need to start paying more attention to it. We need to start developing it more, right? It's going to all be, how do we build up to that?
And some examples of things that might look like that would be, maybe we've got specific items that are very near term on the roadmap that are going to be, they're going to increase customer retention, or they're going to increase conversion, or they're going to increase lifetime value of a customer. Whatever these feature sets we believe might do these, and of course, these are also framed as hypotheses, but all of these should still tie back. Like, why do we even care? I mean, obviously, there's some probably assumed reasons that we would care about things like increasing lifetime value of customers or increasing conversions or things like that. But those should still tie back to whatever key business objectives we have. So, you know, that sort of starts tickling into a different topic that we talk about called strategy deployment. And that's kind of when Melissa started off by saying strategy deployment ends up in this kind of operational mode of road mapping. And that's where kind of the rubber starts meeting the road. But the value needs to be all aligned up and down, everything in the roadmap. I would even say, kind of branching into the strategy deployment thing, if strategy has been deployed well, the individual contributors and the frontline managers that are taking the nearest term roadmap items forward, if they can't tell you how that thing that they're working on helps achieve a product initiative that helps achieve an organizational strategic intent, then strategy has not been deployed well. That doesn't necessarily mean that the strategy doesn't exist or that the strategy is bad. It just means that it's not been deployed well. If people can't state it, if people at the front lines can't use your organizational strategy to make trade-off decisions, then you don't really have an effective strategy. And that will be seen in the roadmap. I mean, we see it all the time, because one of my favorite ways to first set up and visualize the roadmap is set up the structure of the roadmap. And we're visualizing it, especially as in a physical board, set up the structure of the roadmap the way you would like it to be, but then put the work in the roadmap in the state that it's in, and then somehow visually tag like a red sticker or a red hash mark on the front of a card any work that's in violation of a rule that you've created with the structure. And quite frankly, like, companies big and small basically are just violating themselves all over the place. So, you know, they say how they would like the work to work, but then they show you that none of the work is working how it should be.
I like the idea that your job, Matt, is to show clients how they're violating themselves.
Yeah. And then really, we just want to help, you know, violate them
too. No.
Oh, God. Maybe edit that out.
He's really good at sales.
This is not your mom and pop's Agile podcast.
You know, Chris was asking what other, you know, what elements are you taking out from the way we've roadmapped in the past or adding in to this concept? And one of the things I keep hearing you guys come back to is kind of closing this feedback loop too. And I think that sounds really cool, because you're using the data to connect back to, did you deliver to the right strategy? And using that to drive your future commitments. And that's such a missing component of how we typically roadmap, right? It's just one very push.
Yeah, I think too, like, it's a really good thing to just point out again, every time something moves through a phase in this roadmap, right, and it's getting pulled into the next bucket, which means we're putting more time, more effort into actually figuring it out, we have data to justify that, right? Like, it doesn't get moved just because we're like, oh, that's the next one on the list. Like, it gets moved because it passes a certain criteria.
And I guess, like, another thing, and we haven't talked about this much at all yet, but the way we visualize the work is it needs to, the roadmap, because part of our goal is to help organizations become product-led. And that's much more than just how do we help product managers do product management. And so what winds up happening is, like, the roadmap itself isn't just a set of features that product managers are planning and product development teams are delivering on. We wind up having stratifications in the roadmap for, like, swim lanes for architecture. So we believe strongly in things like product-led architecture, product-led re-architecture initiatives when those exist. And also another swim lane for things like business support or go-to-market support. So we actually use the living roadmap not just for a list of features and what state they're in, but the kind of the tasks or initiatives that need to align across sort of the major functions of the organization to make sure that we're holistically delivering product that's both meeting customer needs and delivering on business value.
Yeah, I peeped your slide share on the topic.
That's an old one. Is that the one with the toilet bowl?
I would love to tell you I knew exactly what you were talking about. I can't remember one or the other, but it may have been old. But what you're describing, though, I remember seeing a slide where something that seems almost common, but not done regularly, which is everything that's involved with creating software, instead of just cranking out, you know, features like we see most often, but also what does it take to get this stuff out and sustained in the real world, like every single representation of the work of a product should be represented, is what I feel like you're describing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's another problem that we see in organizations, is that, you know, the roadmap is just the features. And that's never really what it takes, right? And part of that's why it's the, you know, the stack of lies, the promises that get broken is, you know, I've seen organizations where there's a head of product and a head of tech, and they're not aligned at all. And like there's technical objectives or re-architecture projects or whatever. And, you know, they're talking not very much at all about how do these things actually help. And the funny thing is, you know, I think part of what makes an organization truly product-led is most other things tend to be subjugated to product, meaning the idea is like what we wind up doing as a company is how we deliver value is through our products and services. And everything else, you know, at a top-line perspective is playing support to that. So that doesn't mean that things like architecture, technical debt choices, that those aren't necessarily so burdensome, that those might bubble up to the top. But still, we should be speaking about those things through the lens of how are we generating value in the market? And I think that's kind of what's key. Nobody chooses to upgrade Oracle. Like nobody wants to. There's never a new feature in Oracle that anybody wants. It's probably a lie, but it's probably pretty true. You upgrade Oracle because your support contract's about to run out and they're not going to extend your support contract on your current version of Oracle. And that's shitty because at the end of the day, that means like a year or 6 months of your dev team's life is going to be taken away from shipping value add features to upgrade it. And hopefully somebody's done the math to figure out the risk of not having that support contract is worth it versus the validated features you're not shipping because you're doing that work instead.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I was thinking when you were saying where you run into that, I guess, division both of priorities and planning from tech and product. I've even seen organizations that keep those roadmaps separate, where engineering or tech may have their own roadmap around things like you're describing with upgrades that doesn't even line up or take into consideration what's on that product roadmap. When you guys talk about this concept of a product-led organization, when you're introducing these concepts and bringing a lot of these new ways of looking at the roadmap and tying that into strategy, where in an organization do you often meet resistance?
All the places.
Everywhere.
Where do you not meet resistance?
I think it's uncomfortable on a bunch of levels, right? And it's probably all stems from a very similar thing. There is a fear with leadership, right? When you move to something like this, because they're like, oh, I don't get my Gantt chart. That means I don't have everything, you know, lined out with all the dates that I want on it and what I'm actually going to get. I need to know what I'm going to get. And usually that reaction comes from leadership teams that just don't understand software delivery, right? Like they've never done it before. They've never actually been in the trenches, like trying to build software like that, and know that it's really hard to predict some of those things. It doesn't mean it's impossible, right? But it's hard, right? There's an art to it. And you know, you get held accountable for different things when you're at the leadership level as well. It's very different. So there's probably different pressures on you. So we reach a sometimes resistance there where it feels a little, to them, they feel a little scared by it because they, even though you might not get all the things that are on your Gantt chart, it still makes you feel comfortable that they're actually there.
Yep.
Right. And it's not a problem until you miss all your release dates and then we'll all freak out. But like, as long as it's there, I feel comfortable. I'm like, I can see it. I can see what I'm going to get. And then you've got this willing suspension of disbelief, right? Like that these things will actually manifest one day.
Yeah.
Like they don't want to think about it now. They'll think about it later. So we experience it there. We experience it a lot on the teams as well, because I've met a team that was like a whole company that was like, no, 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 we don't do roadmaps. Like roadmap's a dirty word. We tried roadmaps and our sales team stole them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they went and they sold everything that was on it and we weren't going to build it. So like, we don't even want a roadmap. So even when you try to introduce this concept to them, they've been, you know, scarred by previous experiences and they're afraid anything they write down will just be like grabbed from sales. I think that comes back to more of a cultural problem, right? Rather than a logistical problem with this. And I think in order to be product led, there has to be an understanding that everything that we do in this company is for the good of our, you know, of furthering our business so that we can provide value to both our business and our customers, right? That's everything that we're doing is for that, which means we're not going to include practices that mean selling whatever we can to get, you know, whatever money we possibly can, which is unsustainable in the long run, right? If we're building features, one-off features for all of our customers who request them, you can't scale a company that way. You might as well be a consultancy service or an agency because you cannot scale a product company that way. Yet getting out of those modes is usually the biggest resistance to this type of thinking, right? Like you first have to tackle those cultural problems.
And it's just because they're used to winning at the game they've been playing, exactly. Which isn't wrong. It's just, you know, if
you got to play a different game to scale.
If sales folks have been making their bread because they promise one-off features that don't exist and every single rep is competitive in doing it that way, you know, that got the company to where they're at.
Yeah.
And like, who are we to come in and say that's bad? But what we can say is that that's not going to scale. That's not going to help get you to the next level. And just picking on sales because it's an easy example, when you do have a product that then evolves towards product market fit, and you can tell salespeople, sales reps, like what is the customer profile? What kind of market segment or segments should they be targeting? And when they start realizing that it actually makes their sales jobs like way easier, mm-hmm. They tend to love it. Like, yeah. Because, you know, and the ones that don't, it's because the old incentive system was not optimal for a product-led organization, or it was people that had really great individual personal networks, which is fine for maybe getting something off the ground. But again, in terms of scale for a company and resiliency isn't the best, because if that guy leaves, that network is gone. So, I mean, there's all sorts of interesting things that sometimes resistance is an indication of a cultural challenge that we should dig in deeper to. Sometimes resistance is because there's a process with rewards associated with it that we need to figure out how to change the rewards before we change the process. And sometimes it's actually just an example of maybe something that doesn't need to be in the org anymore now that we're moving to, a different phase of being.
Yeah. No, I love the analogy of it being like almost a security blanket of it makes everybody feel better to have one, even if we all agree that it's never accurate and never comes to fruition the way we've planned. We keep doing it that way because that's the way we've always done it. And it makes us feel better that there's a plan. I feel like we see that a lot, unfortunately.
Plans are comfortable, right? Like as humans, we crave plans. Like we like it because it's like, ooh, I know exactly what I'm going to do next, right? But that doesn't usually add up at the end of the day. And that's just something that we have to recognize in highly uncertain domains, right? Plans don't work out exactly as you need it. And that's the whole concept of a roadmap too, right? Like, I don't know why roadmaps got construed to mean like Gantt charts, right? First we do this, then we do that, and then we do it all by this date. Because if you think of what like an original roadmap was, it was like a piece of paper with all the routes you could possibly get to. That you could be like, here's where I am now. Here's where I'm going. Here's all the possible routes we could get there, right? And let's say we're driving and all of a sudden there's a tree down on my road. I got to pull out my roadmap again and figure out how do I navigate around it or what are the other routes I can take. So it was a guide.
I feel like traditional roadmaps are more like, I'm going to date myself here a little bit, but the old AAA triptychs, where you would get your route planned for you.
Yeah.
And the triptychs were pieces of paper. They were booklets. They were about 12 inches long or so and only 4 inches wide. And if you deviated off of the triptych plan, you didn't know, like there was no rest of the map because you only got the portions of the map for the route and like maybe a mile or two off of the exits that they gave to you. And if you decided, hey, I want to take the scenic route and jump on a U.S. highway instead of the interstate, you were screwed. Like you would just try to wing it, or you'd have to go buy a map from a gas station.
Can you still do that? Do you know? Has anybody tried to buy a map at a gas station recently?
They're way more expensive now, but you know.
I want to thank you guys both for taking the time to talk through this with us today. And any closing thoughts you have on organizations that are interested in adopting this approach, where they can begin to start to get information, or either from one of you, or just in general on how they could be road mapping differently?
Yeah, we are in the process of writing a blog post on this, so that will be out shortly. And you can find it on productslabs.com.
I hear books coming out soon.
Oh yeah, my book's coming out eventually. I wouldn't say soon. That would mean that there are requirements that are done for it that it is not. It's in progress. It's very close to being, it is much closer being done than it was if you asked me a year ago.
It's a living published date.
It's a living published date. That date has moved for many times, especially if you've seen any of my presentations over the last year. It's like every time I give it, I just change the month in the last slide of when it's coming out. And then I had to change a year when it got to December. So anyway, that's coming out. So Escaping the Build Trap will be out later this year. It definitely will be out. It's almost done, I swear. And being published by O'Reilly. So that will be a lot about how to be a product-led organization, all different stuff on there. You'll find some good stuff about road mapping. Yeah, and then we teach an online course called productinstitute.com. It's a 10-week class. It's all online, which is great. So we have over 400 people who've been through it publicly. We've had a lot more in enterprises as well who buy licenses for that. But that's all the fundamentals of how to be a great product manager and how to remain customer focused and goal oriented, which we really promote. So we're there. Matt's going to be, are you speaking anywhere?
Not speaking. Oh yeah, I'm speaking at Agile, whatever year this is, 2018. On the data track. So we're going to be talking about things like cost delay for prioritization. So that'd be cool. We'll actually be at, I won't be speaking, but Products Labs will be running something called Product Lab. You see, we got very innovative with the name at the Agile Dev West conference this year, where we'll basically be there for 2 days and we'll be able to help people go through various practices, one of which will be living roadmaps. So if they happen to be at those conferences, feel free to stop by our little area and hang out for a while.
Yeah. I'll be in Ireland in June in Cork, keynoting RebelCon, which I'm really excited about. So if you're around Europe and you want to come to an amazing software event, we're going to be around, I think it's the third week of June in Cork. RebelCon will be there.
Very
excited about that. Yes. And I'll be at Productized Lisbon in November as well.
Wonderful. That's a great circuit you guys got.
I'm going to be in Vegas too, Matt, so we need to hang.
Yeah, definitely. We can get a meter of margarita together.
Uh-huh. What? I don't even want... Do I want to know what that is?
It's too strong. I can only do half a meter myself.
I hear they can bring IVs into your room.
Yeah. I even know how to tap them if you need help. So.
It's just full of skills.
You never know when you need that. Needles in the arm.
I mean, the quotes on this podcast are going to be just precious.
Well, thank you guys both for taking the time to talk to us today. And how about on Twitter? Where can we find you both on Twitter?
Yeah, Matt's at Matt Farcoon.
And Melissa's at Lissy G.
Lissy with an I.
Lissy with an I. Great. Highly recommend all the materials you guys post and share and just talked about sharing here. I always refer people to follow both of you on Twitter as well. You guys share a lot of great material and otherwise snarky feedback.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's mostly snarky feedback.
Mostly snarky feedback. And no matter what anybody says, we're not actually enemies of anything.
Yes.
We are maybe snarky.
We're just snarky. We're just very snarky.
I heard you hate roadmaps.
Follow something passionately, but don't take anything too seriously.
Yes.
I love it. Well, thank you guys a ton for joining us tonight, and we will talk to you guys hopefully again soon.
Yeah, see you guys
talk
around.
See you soon. Bye.